You'll find my text for this morning in verse 19 of Psalm number 78. Yea, they speak against God. They said, can God furnish a table in the wilderness? And I want to highlight the question that is asked here. Can God furnish a table in the wilderness? This question was asked by the children of Israel in the days of Moses as they traveled and journeyed through the wilderness toward the promised land. The psalm then is what we might describe as an historic psalm. As you read through the book of Psalms, you see that some are psalms of prayer. They record prayers, pleas unto the Lord. Some record praise. They're completely given over to the praise of the Lord. Some require or record instruction, and others record history. And this is one of those historical psalms where the psalmist is recounting or retelling the story of Israel's history. It is, in fact, the longest historical psalm in the Psalter. And it begins with a determination from the people of God in the psalmist's time. It's a psalm of Asaph. It was written around the time of David. It may have been a psalm for Asaph. But if you look at verse 4, you will see that there's a determination. We will not hide them from our children, showing to the generation to come the praises of the Lord and His strength and His wonderful works that He hath done. The Lord revealed Himself unto His people in the law and in the parables, and the people now are determining that they will not hide the Word of God. They'll not keep them away from the children that are to come, and their children, and the generation, but rather they would show unto them the praises of the Lord. And that ought to be our determination as Christian parents, grandparents. We can only influence our children for so long. And while they're young and yet of tender years, when they can be taught and instructed and influenced, it should be our determination that we will not hide from them the wonderful works of the Lord, but rather teach to them the law of the Lord and set them continually that blessed example. For it is our desire, and this is not what I'm preaching on this morning, but it is worth bearing in mind as we set the context. It is our desire and our prayer, verse 6 and 7, that the generation to come might know them. Verse 7, that they might set their hope in God. That has to be the ultimate aim, the ultimate goal, the ultimate prayer, the ultimate desire of every Christian parent, that our children and the generation to come will set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments. And we should determine, like the psalmist, that we will not hide them from the children. And while they are under our influence, and I can tell you, there comes a time when they will grow beyond the parental influence. And I think we would all be in agreement with that and understand what I'm saying and where I'm coming from. But while they are under our influence and under that age where they are under our responsibility, Let us as Christian parents use all the influence we have to set before our children. And then the influence we have with grandchildren. The works of the Lord. That's their determination. That's the psalmist's determination. But as it begins with that determination, it continues with an exhortation in verse 8. You see, it says, and might not be as their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that set not their heart aright and whose spirit was not steadfast with God. And so the psalmist is saying, let us not be like this generation that was before. And the generation he had in mind was the generation of those who traversed the wilderness with Moses, exited Egypt, made their way to the promised land. And he begins to recount their history. And by the time he comes to verse 19, he is particularly referring to an incident that took place in Numbers 11. When the people came to a place called Taberah, and among the mixed multitude, they came and they questioned God through Moses whether he was able to supply their needs in the wilderness. Now he's saying in general, this was a generation that questioned the Lord in the wilderness, and we don't want to be like them. Rather, we want to set our hope in God, and we want to teach it to our children, and we want them to set their hope in God, that they'll not forget the works of the Lord. But he's using the wilderness time as an illustration of what they did not want to be like. And when you come to verse 19, they're recounting, and the psalmist is recounting, how they questioned the Lord. And he terms it like this: can God furnish a table in the wilderness? Could God supply for them as they traveled from Egypt through the wilderness and were there for 40 years? Could God meet their needs in that place? And I say to you this morning, there's a lesson for us from this question and from this time in the wilderness. You see, in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul, referring to the inspired history, he said in Romans 15 and verse 4, that these things, the historical accounts of the Old Testament people of God, they were written for our learning and for our admonition. In 1 Corinthians 10 verses 5 and 6, referring to the sins of the wilderness era specifically, he stated that they were examples that we should not lust after their evil ways. And so the Apostle Paul is saying that the New Testament believer should be looking at Old Testament history and should be gleaning the lessons and learning the lessons from Old Testament history. There are virtues that we can follow, but there are sins that we should avoid. And I'm saying to you that this question has much to teach the New Testament believer about our pilgrimage. For, dear child of God, you're on a pilgrimage too. Not from Egypt to Canaan, but from the world to heaven. Egypt's a type of the world. Canaan is a type of our eternal inheritance. And our journey from the world to heaven is pictured and mirrored in Israel's wanderings in the wilderness. And I'm suggesting then that the question before us, can God furnish the table in the wilderness? It reveals a number of important lessons that we should learn as we live the Christian life in this world. The question, first of all, exposed a great sin. Can God furnish a table in the wilderness? It's a question that is questioning God's ability. It's questioning God's power. It's questioning God's love. It's questioning God's care for them and His willingness and His ability to provide for them in their journey through the wilderness. And this passage and chapter makes it clear that it's sin. It was a sin to question the Lord. Look at a number of verses in the psalm. Look at verse 17. They sinned yet more. Oh, they'd sinned before this. But they sinned yet more. And it says they sinned yet more against Him, against God, by provoking the Most High. Their actions, their thoughts, their words, their question, it was sinning against God, and it was a provocation to God. Look at verse 18. They tempted God in their heart by asking meat for their lust. There's a sinning against God. There's a provoking of God. There is a tempting of God. Look at verse 19. Yea, they speak against God. Oh, the Israelite would say, we're only asking the question. But the Lord says they're speaking against Him. Their question speaks against God. Their question is a denial of God and a doubting of God. And in essence, what is the sin at the heart of their question? There is no doubt that there was carnal lust in their hearts, yet their question evidently centered upon the sin of unbelief. They doubted the Lord. And in their hearts they denied that the Lord would meet their needs. They were challenging Moses and declaring through this question that they denied and doubted whether God could supply their needs in the wilderness. It was a place of dryness, a place of dearth, a place where there was no growth, no vegetation, no animal livestock other than what those that the Israelites had with them who also needed their needs supplied. And their question is, can God set a table for 2 million of His professing people as they journey through the wilderness? Do you know the fact that it was a sin of doubt and unbelief again is confirmed in the psalm? Look at verse 22. Because they believed not in God. They believed not in God. Look at verse 32. For all this they sinned still. For all that God had done, they sinned still and believed not for His wondrous works. You can see here that their sin was aggravated. It was made worse. Because the Lord had displayed for them already His mighty hand, His giving power, His supply for them. And this is what makes this sin even more offensive to God, even worse in His sight. For all this, they sinned still and believed not in His wondrous works. Just ask yourself for a moment what God had already done for this people. And we read it together. Look at verse 11. They forgot His works and His wonders that He showed them. Take in what the psalmist is saying. He performed great works, wondrous works, miraculous works, and He showed those works to them. They were eyewitnesses of His mighty, supernatural, miraculous power to meet their needs. They seen it with their eyes, and what did they see? They beheld the plagues in Egypt. Marvelous things did he in the sight of their fathers, in their sight in the land of Egypt. He turned the water to blood. He sent the frogs and the lice and the flies. When he sent the pestilence to the Egyptian cattle, he spurred the Israelite cattle. What a miracle that was. When he sent the plague of boils, he separated the Israelites. When he sent darkness, there was light in Goshen where the Israelites dwelt. They witnessed the mighty power of God in the land of Egypt to meet their needs, to overthrow their enemies. And they beheld it with their own eyes. When they came out of Egypt, the psalmist goes on, it wasn't just 10 plagues that they saw. But look at verse 13. He divided the sea. You put yourself in the position of one of the Israelites. There was over 650,000 men, their wives, their children, the elderly. On top of that, a conservative estimate of 2 million people leaving Egypt. And they come with Moses to the Red Sea. And Pharaoh has his armies behind them. And they're going to slay them and put them to death. And the Lord opens the Red Sea and it stands as a heap. It wasn't a shallow pond, as the modernist wants us to think, the Reed Sea, where it was just reeds and swamp land. No, the water stood on a heap. And you place yourself in that situation and think, as you're walking through the Red Sea and the water standing on a heap on your side, and you see it with your own eyes. That's what this generation saw. And the Lord's emphasizing it. They saw my wonders, the plagues in Egypt, and how I put a division between Israel and the Egyptians. And I brought them out, and I opened the sea before them, and I brought them through, spurring them and saving their lives. And if that wasn't enough, verse 14, he led them with a cloud during the day and with the light of fire by night. And there's the visible token of God's presence. And when the Lord wants them to move to another place, the cloud moves. His presence goes before them and leads them. And at night, in the wilderness where there's no street lights and there's no torches, how are they going to see? Well, the fire, the pillar of fire, led them by night, lit up the way, and they saw it with their eyes, God's wonders for them. Yet now, verse 19, they're sinning all the more. They're tempting God and they're questioning in unbelief the God who sent the plagues to Egypt. God who put a division between Israel and Egypt. God who opened the Red Sea. God who's leading them by the cloud and the fire. Can God furnish a table in the wilderness? Oh, how great was their sin of unbelief. They questioned and they doubted the Lord to provide. The sad reality is that the professing church and even the true believer in Christ can be afflicted and oppressed and suffer from unbelief. You remember the man that came to Jesus asking him to heal his child, was afflicted of the devil. And the Lord said, if thou believest, all things are possible. He said, Lord, I believe. Help thou mine unbelief. And there are times whenever the sin of unbelief can still plague the heart of a true child of God, traveling through the wilderness of this world, We can wonder, we could question, we could doubt God's care, God's provision, God's love. Didn't the disciples do it in the little ship that was crossing the Sea of Galilee? Master, do you not care that we perish? They questioned the Lord and His care and whether He could meet their needs as they faced death in that storm. Especially in trying or difficult times. Even though we have witnessed the saving, the delivering for some, the healing power of God in their lives. Even though we have witnessed the saving, His providing, His healing power in our lives, His care for us. We can be brought to a situation where there enters in a question of doubt. And I say to every child of God that finds themselves in those circumstances, look to the children of Israel, listen to their question, note it as a warning that none of us will manifest what God called. Or through the Apostle Paul in Hebrews, God called an evil heart of unbelief. And if ever you are tempted in such a situation, remember the verses of Paul in Romans chapter 8, I believe it is. If God spared not His own Son, listen to this. He that spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all, Romans 8 and 32, how shall He not with Him also freely give us all things? What is Paul saying there? If God didn't spare His Son, but slew Him on the cross of Calvary, saw Him put to death on the cross of Calvary to meet your greatest need, the need of your soul's salvation, then how shall He not with Him also freely give us all things? He will meet your every need in life. He will freely give you all that you need. Friend, whatever situation you come into, never question or doubt that the Lord will not meet your need. This question exposed a great sin. I have to move quickly on this morning and say that this question experienced a great supply. Israel asked the question in doubt to provoke God. God answered the question to display His power to man, because God gave them an answer to their question. And you know, if we just change the wording slightly, it's really a true reflection of our God. The question is, can God furnish a table in the wilderness? But if we were to answer the question, we'd change two words. We'd change the words, can God, and we'd just swap them around. God can furnish a table in the wilderness. That's the answer. And that's the answer that God gave them. They said, can God furnish a table? And God answered, God can furnish the table in the wilderness. And that's an accurate assessment. For the psalmist said in Psalm 23, Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. And though the Israelites were in an extreme situation, the wilderness where nothing lives, the Lord sustained His people for 40 years. The wilderness where there is dryness and barrenness and death, God provided to save and sustain His people in extreme and difficult circumstances, not just for one day, not just for one week, not just for one year, but for 40 years. He provided, He supplied their needs. And the psalm tells us how He did it. Look at verse 20. Behold, He smote the rock, that the waters gushed out. Supernaturally, he told Moses, smite the rock. And the rock was smitten and water came out. Look at verse 23 and 24. Though he had commanded the clouds from above, he opened the doors of heaven, he rained down manna. He's in charge. He can work supernaturally. But he can also control nature. He is the God of nature. And he ordered the clouds. And in such a way that they sent down dew upon the ground. And when the dew was taken up from off the ground, there was a little hoar frost that was left, and it was the manna. It was the angels' food, and they would take it and they would crush it and they would bake unleavened bread with it. And he so controlled nature that manna was provided. And then in verse 26, he controlled the nature again because he caused an east wind to blow in heaven. And by his power, he brought in the south wind and it rained. The wind brought the flesh also upon them as dust, the feathered fowls like as the sand of the sea. He sent quails as the sand of the sea and they ate. And they ate till they were full. In what seemed humanly impossible circumstances for the people of God to be sustained, God set the table. God put the food upon the table. Not for one day or one year, but for 40 years, he furnished a table in the wilderness. And I want to say to you, dear child of God, by way of encouragement, God's power has not diminished. He is the same yesterday and today and forever. God's promise has not been done away with. He has said through the Apostle Paul, my God shall supply all of your needs. Like the psalmist, we can say, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. And no matter how difficult, how extreme your difficulties, your trials, your circumstances may be, God can and God will meet your need. God can furnish the table in the wilderness. You know that little phrase, God can. It's a wonderful phrase, God can. Do you know there's only three things in the Bible it tells us God cannot do? Titus 1 verse 2, he cannot lie. 2 Timothy 2 verse 13, he cannot deny himself. In other words, he can't go against his nature. He cannot do something that is contrary to his divine attributes. And James 1 verse 13 says he cannot be tempted with evil. In other words, he cannot sin. Those are the only three things the Bible tells us God cannot do. He cannot lie, he cannot deny himself, he cannot be tempted with evil. My friends, everything else, God. There's a little chorus the children sing, God can do anything, anything. My friends, God can meet your need. Have you a need today? Do the outward human circumstances seem impossible to be provided for or to sort out? Then look in faith to the one who is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we can ask or think, and steadfastly trust in him that in his time and his way and in his will, he will meet the need. Can God furnish a table in the wilderness? It exposed a great sin. It also experienced a great supply. But finally, this morning, this question evidenced a great salvation. You see, if God not only furnished a table for the children of Israel in the wilderness, they would have quickly died. If God hadn't have furnished a table in the wilderness, they would have quickly died. They would have dehydrated without water. Without food, they would have perished, and all their graves would have been in the wilderness, and there would have been none to enter into the promised land of Canaan. But in God setting the table, in God placing the food upon the table, He saved them from death and He sustained them throughout their entire pilgrimage through the wilderness. And that's what God has promised to do for His children in this life. From Egypt to Canaan, the Lord will sustain and provide. But do you see the provision that God gave? It's all a picture of Christ. What God said on that table, the table was set in the wilderness. What did He put on it? Well, I've already highlighted. Verse 20, he set upon it the water, pure water. He smote the rock and the waters gushed out. It was the purest water coming out of that rock. My, purer than any human well. The purest of water was set upon that table. And then, in verse 24 and 25, and had rained down manna upon them to eat. Man did eat angels' food. What did they make with the manna? They made the bread, the unleavened bread. And so there's water and there's bread. And then for the carnivores like me, there was flesh. There was meat to eat. For the quails came into the camp or on the borders of the camp, and they gathered the quails and they ate of the flesh thereof. And each one of them pictures and typifies Christ. For in John chapter 4 and verse 14, Jesus said to the woman at the well, "The woman, the water that I shall give shall be in him a well of living water. He shall never thirst again." Jesus Christ is the water of life. And when you drink of the water of Jesus Christ and His salvation, you'll never thirst again. He's the water of life on the table for the sinner to drink. But in John chapter 6, He's also the bread of life. He said, "Your fathers ate manna in the wilderness and are dead." But He said, "I am the bread of life. And you eat of Him, you'll never hunger and you'll never perish." And in John chapter 6, verse 54 and 55, He said, "He that eateth my flesh and drinketh my blood hath eternal life." He's not talking about the communion table. He's not talking about the bread and the wine becoming His flesh and His blood. No, He's saying that His body and His flesh will be given as a sacrifice. And whoso partakes of that sacrifice, we partake in faith. We feed on Him by faith. And those that put their faith and their trust in the sacrifice of His body and His soul and His blood and His flesh upon the cross have eternal and everlasting life. Now, if you're in the meeting and you're not saved and you're not a Christian, you're in the wilderness of this world, you're going to perish in your sin. But the Lord has set a table that will save you and will sustain you. And on that table, it's Jesus Christ. He's the water of life. He's the bread of life. He's given His flesh and blood at Calvary, that whosoever believeth in Him and partakes of Him by faith will not perish but have everlasting life. The table's set. Have you heeded the invitation? The table's set. The invitation is given. Will you come and dine? If you're not saved, you need to feed upon Him. Partake of Him for the saving of your soul. If you are saved, you continue to feed on Him by faith to sustain you through the wilderness of this life, that God will meet your needs and bless your soul until the day in our He takes us to the eternal kingdom in heaven. We close today not with a question but with a statement. God can furnish a table for you. God can meet your needs in the wilderness of this life. Therefore, never doubt Him. Always trust Him.